Picture a German shopkeeper in Bradford, England, watching his neighbors turn into an angry mob. Karl Hellenschmidt had come seeking prosperity, but World War I transformed him from immigrant success story to enemy alien. His shop was ransacked, his wife nearly killed, and he was thrown into an internment camp. At 12 years old, his son Charles had to run the family business while his mother spiraled into depression. This wasn't ancient history. Charles was the grandfather of economist Paul Collier, whose family story reveals a truth we often forget. Migration debates aren't abstract policy discussions. They're about real people navigating impossible choices in a world of staggering inequality. When Bill Gates named this book among his five favorites of 2019, he wasn't just endorsing academic analysis. He was pointing to something rare in our polarized age, a framework that treats migration as neither threat nor panacea, but as a complex phenomenon demanding our most careful thinking. Migration has become the third rail of modern discourse, electrified by guilt, fear, and moral certainty. In progressive circles, questioning open borders risks being labeled xenophobic. In conservative spaces, acknowledging migration's benefits invites accusations of naivete. We've created a conversation where nuance goes to die. The problem runs deeper than political tribalism. Psychologist Jonathan Haidt discovered that our moral judgments don't follow from reasoning, they precede it. Liberals emphasize care and fairness, seeing migrants as vulnerable people deserving compassion. Conservatives prioritize loyalty and social cohesion, viewing rapid demographic change as destabilizing. Neither side is simply reasoning their way to conclusions. They're rationalizing moral intuitions they already hold. Think about how these conversations actually unfold. Someone presents data showing immigration's economic benefits. The response shifts to cultural concerns. Someone raises integration challenges. The counterattack evokes humanitarian obligations. We're not debating the same question. We're speaking different moral languages entirely. What we desperately need is clear-eyed analysis, examining migration's effects on three distinct groups: migrants themselves, the societies they leave, and the communities that receive them. After World War I, an unprecedented economic divergence emerged. By 1960, the income gap between rich and poor countries reached historic proportions, driven by differences in social models, the institutions, norms, and organizations determining whether societies prosper or stagnate. When a worker moves from Nigeria to Norway, their productivity often increases tenfold, not from sudden intelligence gains, but from switching social models. Migration operates through a self-reinforcing cycle. Wide income gaps combine with large diasporas and rising incomes in origin countries to generate substantial flows. Paradoxically, rising incomes accelerate migration by making it affordable to more people. Most critically, migration produces diasporas, which facilitate more migration. Between 1960 and 2000, migrants from poor to rich countries grew from under 20 million to over 60 million. Diversity brings genuine benefits: cultural richness, innovation, fresh perspectives. But it also frays mutual regard, the practical sympathy making people willing to pay taxes for strangers' healthcare. Robert Putnam's research revealed something troubling. Higher immigrant proportions correlated with lower trust, not just between immigrants and natives, but among natives themselves. People in diverse neighborhoods participated less in community activities, had fewer friends, and watched more television, hunkering down. Three visions shape how societies absorb newcomers. Multiculturalism celebrates cultural separatism. Assimilation expects adoption of host norms, and fusion envisions creative blending. Despite falling from fashion, assimilation aligns with the golden rule. Few people from poor countries would accept permanent enclaves of rich foreigners in their midst, yet multiculturalism expects exactly this in reverse. Learning the local language proves essential for participating in public life and building mutual trust. European elites have embraced multiculturalism as policy, legitimizing cultural isolation. French second-generation Muslims show increasing religious strictness compared to their parents. British Bangladeshi women adopt full veils not worn in Bangladesh itself. Political separatism follows. Tower Hamlets became a battleground for Bangladesh's feuding parties, while British Muslims created the Respect Party, winning elections by appealing explicitly to identity. Ruud Koopmans' research demonstrates that multicultural policies measurably slow integration. Here's the paradox. Multiculturalism for immigrants, combined with anti-discrimination laws for indigenous populations, creates asymmetry. Immigrants form tight-knit communities preserving origin cultures, while indigenous networks must convert from exclusive bonding to inclusive bridging capital. This violates the golden rule, creating resentment that undermines tolerance. Effective integration requires cracking down on discrimination, requiring geographic dispersion, imposing school integration with diaspora ceilings, and promoting common citizenship symbols, policies acknowledging both migrants' dignity and communities' need for cohesion. Basic economics predicts immigration reduces wages while benefiting capital owners. Reality is messier. British studies found wages decreased at the bottom, but increased along most of the spectrum because immigrants often complement rather than compete with native workers. Housing tells a different story. Poor migrants compete directly with indigenous poor for social housing. British house prices are roughly 10% higher due to migration, a regressive wealth transfer benefiting older property owners while making home ownership harder for young people. The demographic argument that immigrants offset aging populations collapses under scrutiny. Immigration provides only temporary fiscal relief, as immigrants bring both children and parents, potentially increasing dependency ratios. Britain's apprenticeship collapse coincided with rising immigration, with 80% of new jobs during peak years filled by immigrants, revealing divergence between business interests, cheaper recruitment, and indigenous interests, training local youth. The clearest wage effect? Additional immigrants drive down earnings of existing immigrants, competing head-to-head in ways they don't with native workers. Beyond economics, migrants face psychological costs from cultural dislocation that may offset income gains. Rigorous studies suggest migrants experience no happiness improvement despite substantial income increases. The second generation, however, benefits without these costs. Migration as sacrifice for children's opportunities. For the bottom billion in the world's poorest countries, migration's impact on those left behind determines whether they escape poverty. Migration transfers democratic norms. Returning migrants increase voter participation among themselves and less educated neighbors. Host country quality matters. France and the United States prove better seedbeds of democratic values than Russia or authoritarian regimes. Migration also transfers social norms like smaller family preferences and educational aspirations. The talent question cuts both ways. Educated emigrants no longer contribute directly, but migration opportunities create powerful incentives for educational investment. When the initial exodus is large, especially in small countries, talent loss cannot be recovered. Haiti has lost around 85% of its educated people, requiring a sevenfold increase in talent supply to offset an impossible threshold. Almost all small, poor countries end up as losers from migration, while large developing countries like China, India, and Brazil experience net gains. Remittances partially offset these losses. Migrants sent about $400 billion home in 2012, nearly four times global aid flows. In Haiti, remittances constitute 15% of national income. In El Salvador, 16%. Migration helps large developing countries while potentially devastating small poor ones, exactly the opposite of what humanitarian impulses might hope. We need a middle path between xenophobic panic and utopian borderlessness. Migration controls are ethically legitimate. Without them, migration would accelerate rapidly, harming host societies, countries of origin, and migrants themselves. Unrestricted migration could empty poor countries and radically transform host societies' identities. Societies have existence value. Mali should develop, not empty. England shouldn't become merely an extension of Bangladesh. Responsible policy should establish ceilings on settlement migration while encouraging temporary educational migration that benefits source countries. After establishing ceilings, policy must address migrant composition. Family reunification rights should be limited proportionately to what indigenous citizens actually use. Education criteria matter because educated immigrants tend to raise indigenous wages while less educated ones may lower them. On illegal immigration, maintain border controls, but grant those who evade them guest worker status, permitting work and taxation without benefit entitlements while creating paths to full legal status. Mass international migration is temporary, a response to extreme global inequality that will diminish as developing countries converge with high-income nations. One unambiguously positive legacy is that high-income societies have become multiracial, a profoundly liberating development. We face a choice. Let migration accelerate unmanaged until backlash becomes inevitable, or craft policies honoring both migrants' aspirations and communities' cohesion. That future requires neither open borders nor closed hearts, but the courage to think clearly about one of our era's defining challenges.